Bonjour, and welcome to Bon Appetit on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward. In this episode, I'll continue reading from the March 2025 issue, starting with Full Steam Ahead. Steaming is delightfully simple, and there are a lot of tools available to get the job done. Here is a guide to different options to suit every budget, kitchen, and level of steamy enthusiasm. Electric steamer. If steaming is your passion and counter space is no object, a dedicated electric steamer might be for you. This device produces steam in just 1 minute and supports multiple racks, so you can steam several things at the same time. Buy Deem G563 5-quart electric food steamer, $259, Amazon.com. Next, bamboo steamer. These stackable bamboo forms come in a variety of sizes and fit inside a wok or atop a straight-sided pot. The layers allow you to simultaneously steam a variety of ingredients with different cook times. They do tend to warp with heavy use, but you'll get a lot of shumai before that time comes. Joyce Chen, 6-inch bamboo steamer, $30, crateandbarrel.com. Mushinabe. Donabe are Japanese clay pots designed for particular cooking techniques, and this one is designed to steam. It has a perforated ceramic insert that suspends ingredients above the bubbling water in the basin. It's the most expensive steamer on this list, but also happens to be the most beautiful and versatile. Remove the insert, and it can be used for hot pot, braises, and more. Bistro Mushinabe Donabe, $270. ToiroKitchen.com. Toiro is T-O-I-R-O. Last on the list is a steamer insert. A folding metal steamer insert is perfect for the occasional steamers among us. This one fits any pot with a diameter of at least 8 inches, and the handle allows you to easily remove it with a utensil. OXO stainless steel steamer with extendable handle, $23, Amazon.com. Next, I'll be reading Living in the Future of Food. Advances in technology have already carried us and our food into a new age, by Ali Buzari. Long after we've conquered the cosmos, we'll still be eating potatoes. But that doesn't mean that the way we breed, grow, harvest, distribute, prepare, and enjoy those potatoes won't evolve. In fact, it already has. Despite a lack of Jetsonian aesthetics, we have blasted off into a brand new food age over the past decade or so. It hasn't been an easy journey. Food is complicated, and we have a complicated relationship with it. Advances in everything from gene sequencing to satellite photography to the notify button on restaurant reservation apps have provided us with tools to understand our food and ourselves better than ever before. While the rise of artificial intelligence and machine learning have provided us with a means to chart that data into actionable paths forward, here is where the future of food has been hiding. Precision agriculture. Surveillance unlocks keys to sustainable and efficient crops. Along with the institutional knowledge of generations of farmers intimately familiar with the quirks of their land, we've long been able to gather bits of quantitative data about soil composition, drainage, precipitation, and temperature conditions of farms. Those disparate pieces, while helpful in informing a farmer's game plan each season for a single field, have historically lacked a crucial through line to stitch together a bigger picture of how our crops are performing in real time. We now have that thread in the form of satellite imagery. With the help of an abundant low-orbit flock of satellites from private companies and various nation-states, now you can obtain a quality snapshot of a farm or an entire region about once a day. This opens doors for how we farm. Instead of overdosing fields with fertilizer, which is cheap, to hedge against missing out on a boom crop, farmers might be able to target and tailor their fertilizer dosage to areas that need it most, in turn reducing the environmental impact of over-fertilization. When we develop a new crop that has nutrition or flavor advantages but requires more resources to grow, we can lay out those differences in plain quantitative terms, enabling us to make informed choices in cases where human health and climate concerns may not be aligned. We have the ability to learn more than ever about one plot on one farm or thousands of farms scattered around the globe. We can ask and answer questions that were never possible before. Biotechnology, plant breeding for the future present. Food, like all living things, is a wiggly mishmash of molecules that are constantly changing. Old-school crossbreeding is a blunt force technique that smashes two genomes together, and it has historically taken several years, often more than a decade, to sort through the results and weed out all the undesirable genetic debris that hitched a ride with the target genes. For centuries, we had to cross two plants, produce hundreds of offspring, and wait for months or years to see which specimens had the traits we were looking for. With the advent of molecular genotyping techniques in the 80s and 90s, we gained the ability to take a sneak peek at select sections of a baby plant's genome, rather than waiting for its full life cycle to play out. Those techniques were revolutionary, but still slow. Today, we have the ability to analyze millions of plant samples in the time it used to take to plod through dozens, which means plant breeders are unlocking more delicious, nutritious, and prolific crops in record time, shaving years off the time it takes to get a new plant variety ready for market. Even with our supercharged genetic surveillance power, however, there is a ceiling on what can be accomplished without genetic engineering. Technologies like the use of CRISPR, a DNA modification trick we learned from bacteria, allow us to replace the head-on genetic car crash of traditional crossbreeding with the precision of a Formula One pit crew, targeting the exact genes in the exact locations we want them with incredible fidelity. The technology is well established, but the regulatory and cultural discussion surrounding genetic modification is the most polarizing topic in food. With changes in our nutritional needs, flavor preferences, and climate change accelerating at an increasingly alarming rate, it's comforting to know that we don't have to wait for the future to take the next massive technological leap. We've already done it. We just need to decide how to use what we've found. Hyper-personalization, consumer health. What does this food do to me? People with all of our dizzying diversity of genetics, habits, and ages represent some of the most complex systems that science has ever tried to model and understand. Throw food into that chaos blender, and you've got a level of complexity that is literally beyond human comprehension. Megan Fisk-Clements, PhD, a food scientist who specializes in big data sets and the interaction between food and our health, says that the last 5 years constitute the first era in history where we've had the computing power to ask the big questions about the interaction between food and our bodies. Computational work used to be intended to do things like algebra faster than a person can do, but we could eventually figure it out if given enough time. Now we're doing computations that we were never going to be able to do with our own brains. Data gathering tools like continuous glucose monitors, step trackers, and heart rate monitors are widespread, and high throughput methods for analysis like fecal sample sequencing are allowing us to gather quantities of data about how food is affecting our bodies that are beyond our ability to comprehend. AI and machine learning systems, however, can help us do the work that every grad student in every lab in the world would never catch up to. We no longer need to smooth every nutritional data point out into population-scale trends. we can now embrace and learn from all of our individual variations. We have zoomed in on the biochemistry that underpins questions such as which foods have a molecular connection to which diseases, or which foods are best suited to a specific person's genetics and lifestyle. For the first time in our history, we've been able to ask and answer the question, what does this food do to me? Transport retail, protecting produce in the post-harvest world. The slow meandering processes of breeding and growing produce are marathons that gives way to a breakneck sprint the moment it is picked. The product is dying as soon as you remove it from the tree, says Erwin Donis Gonzalez, PhD, and co-director of the University of California, Davis Post-Harvest Research and Extension Center. He and his colleagues in the post-harvest world work to maintain the quality of produce on its journey to market, with the goal of delivering consumers the most delicious, high-quality products possible. That job has gotten easier with improvements in measurement. In addition to more reliable and widespread data on benchmarks like ambient temperature and humidity, advanced metrics such as internal produce temperature and near-infrared data paint a clear picture of the condition of commodities like avocados on their journey from field to market. Aided by this worm's eye view, we can make informed decisions on when to refrigerate to preserve quality or when to let temperatures rise to encourage ripening so that a given crop's arrival to market is perfectly synchronized with peak quality and flavor. The more attention we pay, the more we learn. Improving shock absorbers on transport trucks that carry berries can prevent them from softening, losing color, and becoming less fragrant. Dining evolution. Restaurants digitally reach beyond their dining rooms. Your dining experience used to begin once you walked into a restaurant. Now it can start weeks before your reservation. You can watch the rhythm of daily changes to a restaurant's menu through its Instagram stories, and some restaurants even post movie trailer-style hype videos for new dishes. Innovations like digital reservation notes, food preference profiles, and the notify button feel ubiquitous. But before platforms like Resy, OpenTable, and Talk started noting your proclivities and letting you know when reservations became available, the conduit for conversation between diners and restaurants was ultra narrow. Our broadening digital connection to restaurants has unlocked new possibilities for how they manage their operations. Alex Faulkner, GM of Nancy's Hustle in Houston, spent hours tinkering with the restaurant's Resy profile to tackle one of the issues that plagues most restaurants: how to accommodate as many guests as possible during peak hours without burying kitchen and front-of-house crews. She found that within a time window where a section of the restaurant could accommodate 12 guests, there were massive advantages to booking a 2-top, a 4-top, and a 6-top rather than 6 tables of 2. Parties of 2 tend to get straight to the point of ordering, whereas larger parties are more likely to spend several minutes greeting each other and deciding whether to get a round of appetizers for the table. When programmed into the framework of their reservation system, the information provides automated yet organic pacing to avoid a tsunami of urgent orders without compromising the number of guests that can be seated at the same time. Our futuristic food present has less chrome and robotic beeping than some expected, which might be why this version of the future of food, where subtle, behind-the-scenes innovations orbit around and enhance, not supplant, the real stars of the food system, the food on our plates and the people we share it with, feels comfortingly familiar. We haven't mastered our bodies, our food, or our farms. We've just finally learned to have meaningful conversations with them, and a lot of the major decisions that guide the next phase of our food future will depend on how we collectively feel about what they have to say. The next article I'll be reading is Plant the Seed, Row 7 is taking on Big Produce, One Crop at a Time, by Alex Beggs. The butternut had it coming. Gigantic and often bland, the squash filled our grocery carts and vexed our dull knives for too many years. Dan Barber, author of The Third Plate and co-owner of Blue Hill at Stone Barns in Tarrytown, New York, decided to do something about it. Over the past century, hundreds of seed purveyors were gobbled up by bigger food industry players like Monsanto, who were then bought by agrochemical companies like Bayer. They patented plant genetics that keep our produce aisles a sea of sameness while breeding seeds that rely on something else these companies sell, pesticides. Inspired and incensed, Barber co-founded Row 7 Seed Company, a collaborative line of seeds and produce that partners breeders, farmers, and chefs on a mission to center delicious vegetables on our dinner plates. The baby was the honeynut squash, sweet and thin-skinned. The result of a partnership between Barber and Cornell University plant breeder Michael Mazurek that first hit the market in 2015. Barber says honeynut and its cousin, Hello Honey Patch, are now grown on tens of thousands of acres from coast to coast. Row 7 offers 7 fruits and vegetables and 23 seeds in its catalog, each a credit to the ingenuity of seed breeders eager to share their creations with the world. Plant breeding is as ancient as farming, a process of cross-pollinating plants until you get the beaut you desire. You can grow Row 7 seeds or find its products at farmers markets and Whole Foods across the country. Great marketing also helps. Barber's connection to the dual worlds of farming and fine dining brought Row 7 to restaurants, spreading the word one menu at a time. In Ann Arbor, Michigan, I encountered Row 7's Badger Flame Beets at Spencer, where Chef Abby Olitsky draws up a new menu every month. She was scouring the Ann Arbor Farmers Market when she saw these enormous beets, long and tubular, at the stand from Seeley Farm. She knew exactly what they were, a super sweet beet bred to be less earthy, and filled her cart to roll them to the restaurant. She roasted the badger flames in a shallow bath of olive oil, white wine, and thyme, then crushed and served them in a salad with an oniony creme fraiche and hazelnuts. The color was insane, the most fluorescent bright orange, she said. I inhaled them. These days, Barber is inundated with breeders who want to partner. A portion of sales of plants bred at public institutions goes back to help fund further research, too. Next up is a deep purple, near-black sweet potato that Barber exclaimed is extraordinary. The Row 7 team is working on the potato's name. Purple Majesty? I'm rooting for Purple Nurple. We'll have to wait and see. Sweet Garlic. Savory garlic meets the mellower, oniony sweetness of leeks in this hybrid allium from breeder Hans Bongers. He spent a decade selecting for straight and uniform plants with a tender, not stringy texture, so there's no need to over-trim those dark green tops. Badger Flame Beet. Breeder Irwin Goldman and his lab took about 15 years to develop this mild and sweet beet while studying the exact compound that creates the root veg's usual dirty flavor in the first place, geosmin, and tasting harvest after harvest directly from the field. With orange-red skin and golden flesh, the result is less earthy and astringent and can be eaten raw. Upstate Abundance Potatoes. This low-moisture, golf ball-sized spud from second-generation potato breeder Walter Dijon creates the very essence of potato flavor into every bite. Its ultra-creamy, white flesh tastes nutty, almost like it's already been buttered. Now I'll be reading Low Country Roots Remixed. In South Carolina, Black culinary entrepreneurs are using age-old techniques to sustain culture. Few U.S. cities have so profitably capitalized on their past and their foodways as Charleston, South Carolina. Founded in the late 1600s near Oyster Point, it was one of colonial America's metropolises, fattened by slavery and competing with New York City and Philadelphia in population and port city swag. On the shores of the Atlantic, the region birthed the dynamic Gullah culture and communities of black fisherfolk who gave America shrimp and grits, crab rice, she-crab soup, and the one-pot wonder Hoppin' John. In this region, land, sea, and black labor converged to leave a culinary imprint that has traveled far beyond the Carolina coast. But no matter how much Charleston touts itself as America's most historic city and a bastion of authenticity, cities and foodways survive because reinvention is perpetual. As we toured the South Carolina coast, African-American culinary entrepreneurs showed just how to build off history and not be bound by it. Land and legacy, St. Helena Island. On a drizzly fall day, Sarah Reynolds Green gathers a mess of collards, hugging the bouquet with both arms. The embrace represents the philosophy she shares with the students ages 10 through 17 who attend Marshview Community Organic Farms, Young Farmers, and chefs of the Lowcountry program. When you are out here growing food, your heart has to be clean. Your vibration has an effect on the universe. Green and her chef hunter husband, Bill Green, teach the students farming basics on her family land. She picked peanuts, corn, and okra here as a child before going to Spelman College in Atlanta. In Georgia, she got involved with a legendary, now defunct community health food store, Life's Essentials, and several schools that promoted racial pride, good health, and collaboration. If we can't work together, we can't work, she says. The students tend crops from sowing in the greenhouse to harvesting. The program also gives their families seeds to start home gardens to cultivate Gullah land connections that have been lost to time, off-island migration, and encroaching development. But Green remembers, and she wants to teach because it pains her to hear some youngsters say of agriculture, "I don't want to do that slavery job." The Call of the Water, Brittlebank Park. Tia Clark gently shakes the contents from her crab cage onto a pier off Charleston's Brittlebank Park. She holds aloft a cerulean Atlantic blue crab, fingers safely away from its flailing claws. This beauty is a male. You can tell by the pattern. People say the males have a Washington Monument on his underbody, and the mature female a capital with a pointed dome, she says. Clark, founder of her casual crabbing with Tia ecotourism venture, sounds as if she's always known these things. Black people have worked the waves around Charleston since kingdom come. But though she's a Binya, Gullah for been here or a native, as opposed to a Kumya, this was recent knowledge for her. Clark found the waters after she left behind years of bartending and hard drinking. A cousin took her out crabbing, and heeding a call she didn't quite understand then, she began fishing alone. She made the outdoors my gym, shedding pounds and gaining peace. Today she leads popular tours during which guests accompany her on the water, keep some of the catch they net, or to a local restaurant partner to cook. We all have a right to these natural resources, and it doesn't matter where you came from, how much money you've got, she says. And I want to empower and teach young black kids in the region that our culture is directly connected to the water. If you don't have a relationship with this water and know this water, you probably don't know who you are. History of Ancestors, the Middleton Place Plantation. Distant cousins Ty Collins and Robert Bellinger both descend from some of the 3,000 people enslaved by the Middletons, a prominent Charleston trading and political family. At the Middleton Place Plantation, beside its garden shop and visitors' parking, they've planted the Ashe Garden. It's a small collection of raised beds of herbs to honor the enslaved people whose labor made the estate's world-renowned formal English garden possible. On a recent walking tour, Collins pointed out how enslaved and free people literally shaped the landscape as its primary gardeners and engineers. From its famous stands of camellias, bamboo they planted as fencing, and the strip of earth they constructed between the plantation's rice field and the Ashley River's mix of salt and fresh water. A 14-year-old girl would have been responsible for this, he says, pointing to a watery quarter acre of a demonstration rice field. But little is known about what that girl and her family would have grown to eat in the slave quarters. Billinger, a Massachusetts-based historian of West African Griot traditions, has become a de facto food historian to solve that mystery and hopes he'll soon be able to plumb Middleton Place's private archive to find out. He and Collins are advocating for a larger garden space that's more connected to the property's core, where the grow plants linked to the African diaspora. The ben seed that's a symbol of the region, guinea corn, probably sorghum or millet, and a tomato that might have traveled to North America during the Haitian Revolution. Pushing boundaries, Bluffton. Extreme fidelity to regional specialties can dampen diners' appetites for the novel or a broader history. Bernard Bennett, chef and co-owner of O'Conn Restaurant in Bluffton, 90 miles down the coast, pushes boundaries. His menus offer the holy trinity of rice, seafood, and greens, but much more. Guyanese pepper pot, or a nod to his Senegalese grandmother, and Neb, a black-eyed pea salad. There will always be rice on this menu, he states. A recent menu offered three, including jollof, West Africa's precursor to Low Country red rice, vermicelli with Haitian flavors via Dijon mushrooms, and turmeric-tinted Carolina gold rice. He's firm that shrimp and grits won't make an appearance as he explores less traveled pathways that led to African-American food. When he debuted the West African greens and melon seed stew egusi, it languished on the menu until he rebranded it as spinach soup and instructed servers to describe it as hearty winter comfort in a bowl. He tries to stimulate customers' curiosity, adding glossaries to his menus, but does not coddle them. That is all the time I have to read in this episode. The last piece which I read was titled Low Country Roots Remixed by Cynthia Greenlee. Thanks so much for choosing to listen to these selections from the March 2025 issue of Bon Appetit. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying au revoir for now.